Please.
The only issue that's presented in this case is whether or not the trial court erroneously imposed an exceptional sentence down below the standard range. And we're arguing that there was no legal basis to depart from the standard range and impose a 30-day sentence where the bottom of the range was 22 months. The only factor that appears to be defended on appeal is the second basis the trial court relied upon, which was, and I quote from the conclusion of law, Mr. Fernandez's escape by walking away from Reynolds' work release did not endanger the work release facility, its employees, or other inmates. Our argument is that that is not a sufficient sufficient legal basis upon which to base the decision, probably first and foremost because this crime is categorized by the legislature as a nonviolent offense. So the absence of violence can hardly be surprising and certainly doesn't distinguish this offense from other offenses. The underlying problem is that we're talking here about a legal basis that should constitute a substantial and compelling reason to depart from the usual range. And if you define the exceptional circumstance to be roughly equivalent to the normal circumstance, then it hardly becomes exceptional. So a case like this is really quite typical. I mean, you have somebody who's been assigned to work release, walks away, and never comes back. I can't imagine how a case like that would ever involve violence. It's theoretically possible, I suppose. But that is fairly typical under this statute, and it is actually fairly unusual, I think, to have a violent escape from a correctional facility. So the legislature had to have considered all of those things when they categorized the crime as nonviolent, when they set these standard ranges. And for that reason, I think the court erred in saying that this was a substantial and compelling reason to depart from the range. The court also made a couple of other comments about the fact that there was no danger presented. I think in general that's correct. We're not challenging the court's finding of fact in that regard, although I will note that whenever somebody escapes, there's a warrant that's going to be issued and they have to be brought back. And often in rearresting somebody and bringing them back into custody, you create the potential for violence. So in that sense, I think the court is not exactly correct that this is a harmless situation. The court also made a number of other comments about medical conditions and this defendant having a history of drug use. There seems to be a basis to say that, but on the other hand, the SRA already anticipates that if you have a drug problem and need to address that, you can pursue a drug offender sentencing alternative of a DOSA, and there are a number of other ways to address that rather than simply lopping the majority off of the standard range.
Is there any indication? Did he do any of those things, or was that was any kind of drug or treatment alternative considered with respect to Mr. Fernandez?
Not on the record. The court just expressed concern about that history, and it appears that there had already been negotiations between the state and the defense, of course, to reduce it from escape one down to escape two, where he would have originally faced 44 months. I don't know if those were part of the discussions or not. It's not part of the record. So anyway, but those alternatives are available, and if the court wanted to address those, the court would have been required to find that the defendant suffers from a drug addiction, that the addiction has drives the criminal behavior basically, and that treatment would overall benefit the community more than a reduction in the sentence. So by avoiding the structure the legislature has set up, you avoid that kind of careful analysis about whether it's really the appropriate sentence in these circumstances. So,
are you saying that if the court had conducted that kind of analysis, that it could have arrived at an appropriate exceptional sentence downward that was predicated on some kind of need for treatment?
I think that the court could have imposed a DOSA under these circumstances. I don't believe that under these facts, from what we know from the record, that the court would have been entitled to impose an exceptional sentence because there's just nothing in this record to suggest that this defendant is falls
within
that
category. I guess my
question
was theoretical on another hypothetical record.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. I imagine that you could have somebody that's so hobbled by their drug addiction and so clearly impacted by it that maybe it would constitute a substantial and compelling reason to depart, but not simply the observation that the defendant has committed crimes in conjunction with drug-related
problems. This guy, by his own testimony, he showed up at the sentencing, and he said, the day they sent me out on work release, I got high.
Right. And
talk about a compulsion.
Yes. And there's no question about it. I mean, he probably has a drug problem, but whether or not it drives his criminal behavior or to what extent, and to whether on balance he should be doing 30 days instead of 22 months, or whether he should be going into a structured program, those are all questions that could have been answered if he had explored the DOSA alternative.
Isn't it the case that in his particular sentence, if this had been a first or second offense, he would have had a much lower sentence? I don't know exactly what it was.
Yeah, his offender score would have been lower.
His offender score,
yes,
rather than the nature of the offense, had the biggest thumb on the scale in terms of getting up to the 22 months.
Correct. The difference now between Escape 1 and Escape 2 is that with Escape 1, you escape from custody following a conviction. Escape 2, you escape from any sort of custody. He would have been qualified under Escape 1, but we reduced the charges.
You could have made it fit either one, is what you're saying. Or it would have fit
It fit the greater, that's right. And we negotiated it down to the lesser. But the primary driver was his offender score on the length
of. So second-degree escape, you're saying, is suitable, or at least you might say the typical nature of it would be somebody who hasn't been convicted but who is, like, being held on bail or, I mean.
That's right, pretrial. There's no conviction.
Not on bail, but without bail.
That's right. That's the existing difference between the two degrees.
Or a misdemeanor, possibly, or?
I don't remember that.
Okay.
So I think Escape 1 still, it talks about a conviction. I don't think it distinguishes a felony and misdemeanor.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Gregory Link on behalf of Timothy Hernandez this morning. Judge St. Clair found that 30 days was an appropriate sentence for an individual that's afflicted by drug addiction, where the current crime is the product of that addiction, where his current confinement was the product of that addiction, and where the standard range was going to do nothing to address that addiction. That's not manifestly unreasonable. It's supported by the law, and it's an appropriate sentence here, and I'd ask you to affirm it. Judge St. Clair found that the standard range in this case would have been punishment for punishment's sake. It would have not been an appropriate use of resources. It would have been a draconian response to a medical condition. It would not have afforded treatment. It did not account for the absence of violence, either in the escape or for the crimes of conviction. And it didn't account for the fact that Mr. Fernandez would receive sanctions for his escape from the Department of Corrections, that he would have to serve out the remainder of his sentence with the loss of good time. He would have to do so in a DOC facility and not in a work release. None of those factors were considered by the legislature in setting the standard range for Escape 2. The state points to the absence of violence and says, well, this is a nonviolent offense, so the absence of violence is neither here nor there. But the absence of an element isn't what drives a mitigating factor, because if it's the absence of an element, we're not talking about mitigating factors at all. The person's not guilty. So the fact that violence is or isn't an element of the crime isn't important. The legislature didn't consider, because it's not a violent crime, didn't consider the complete absence of violence. It didn't consider the impulse of an individual who literally says, the day I got there, they gave me a pass, I got high, and I went to the races. We can look at Mr. Fernandez's history. It is driven by drug addiction. We see the drug offenses. We see the property crimes. His current crimes of confinement at the time he was in work release were for possession and identity theft. There is no doubt that Judge St. Clair's findings regarding his medical condition, as Judge St. Clair aptly termed it, was factually supported. And there is no doubt that Judge St. Clair's finding that this is driven by that drug addiction is factually supported. And I think it's important to recognize that with the Supreme Court cases in State versus Graham and State versus Odell, the Supreme Court, I think, has indicated a new dawn in the era of sentencing, that it is okay to consider personal characteristics of individuals to the extent they bear on the crime. Here, his personal characteristic, his drug addiction, plainly bears on this crime. It bears on his culpability for his crime. As he's completing a lengthy prison sentence, the compulsion is such that he immediately goes out and gets high at the first opportunity. That bears on his culpability in the same way that youthfulness bared on the culpability in Mr. O'Dell's case. And the Supreme Court said that's a proper consideration for mitigation at sentencing. To the same degree that the court said in State versus Graham, you have to look at how this sentence comports with this individual, who he is and what he did at this instance. And it's okay to consider personal characteristics. That is a bit of a sea change in how we address sentencing.
But doesn't that argument let you argue that in every drug-related offense, this SRA doesn't apply because culpability is diminished in every alcohol offense?
It certainly does if one can say that the behavior was driven by the addiction, as it is clearly done here. He walked away from work release because he was going to get high. There is no doubt.
He didn't testify to that. He said the day he walked away, he got high.
Yeah, he said they gave me a pass at that the first day I was there, and I went and got high, and I was off to the races. That is what he said. I don't think there's any doubt that that is exactly why he did what he did. And I don't think it's a tremendous stretch beyond O'Dell to say that where a personal characteristic such as drug addiction drives behavior. And I'm not going to use the word compelled because I don't think O'Dell said usefulness compels the behavior. It contributes to the behavior. It drives the behavior to some degree. There is plainly a nexus between that characteristic and the crime. There is plainly a characteristic where usefulness is at stake and many criminal acts committed by young offenders and juveniles. And the Supreme Court has told us that's a proper consideration for courts at sentencing. That's what courts should be doing. That's what makes something exceptional. Because when the legislature set the standard range, either initially in 1984 or in the subsequent 32 years, they didn't necessarily consider the impact of an individual's drug addiction on their culpability for escape. They didn't.
Like, the problem I'm having with your argument is that that isn't what we're looking at in terms of the findings here. I mean, isn't Mr. Wisman correct when he says that this case has been briefed and presented on the question of whether the decision can be defended with the substantial and compelling reason being the nonviolent nature?
No, it's not correct, Your Honor. I'll tell you why it's not. Because first off, at sentencing, Judge St. Clair specifically incorporated his oral findings. The state's never assigned error to those oral findings. It's never addressed those oral findings. So in our response and our responsive briefing, we addressed the issues that the state brought up. The state has never brought up whether drug addiction was a proper basis, as Judge St. Clair believed it was.
Didn't the legislature already set up a process for addressing folks who are suffering from the compunction of drug addiction?
It provides an alternative.
It provides a DOSA.
It does.
Why wasn't that pursued then?
The fact that the legislature addressed a single alternative doesn't necessarily exclude other alternatives. It also provided that the court can impose mitigated sentences. They're not mutually exclusive. It did not say that all drug abuse goes into the DOSA program. It said that courts can have the discretion to impose mitigated sentences. So I think it is clear that Judge St. Clair was relying on drug addiction. The state's never challenged that.
You don't think that the DOSA would be the first option?
It could be.
If you're, it is the scheme that the legislature has enacted.
But again, there's nothing in the SRA.
Consider that prior to deciding to impose an exceptional sentence on that basis?
He could and he may have. We don't know. We didn't enter a finding. And again, there's nothing in the statute, in any statute, that says you must go through it in this fashion. Again, the DOSA is not an exclusive alternative, nor is an exceptional down an exclusive alternative. I think the legislature and O'Dell and Graham have made clear that the court can do what the court did. And I think, again, just to clarify your point, Judge Becker, we addressed what the state said in its opening brief, and since it didn't bother to address any of Judge St. Clair's oral findings, we didn't address any of Judge St. Clair's oral findings. But those findings are perfectly valid. They're there, and I think this court can affirm what Judge St. Clair based on those findings, based on the law that O'Dell and Graham give us and based on the SRA. I'd ask you, and let me just say, too, I think it's important.
Graham, in that line of cases, I mean, Mr. Fernandez, I believe, was 49 years old at the time that he committed, or the time he appeared for sentencing. I mean, this is not a case that falls into the category of the difficulties that adolescents have in controlling their...
And I'm not suggesting it does. What I'm suggesting is that O'Dell has signaled that personal characteristics that...
You said Graham.
Both Graham and O'Dell.
No, you're thinking of the Graham.
I mean State versus Graham. No, not Graham. Not. Not Graham versus Florida, Your Honor. No, State versus Graham, which our Supreme Court remanded a case back in Division III.
Okay, that
saying that the purposes of the SRA were could be properly considered as a basis for a mitigated sentence. I believe it's a 2013. We cited it in our brief. I believe it's a 2013 case. That's the case I'm relying on. No, not Miller, Roper, or JDB. And I do want to clarify, too, that even if this court agrees that with the state that the basis of Judge St. Clair's sentence is improper, I don't think the remedy is to remand for imposition of a standard range sentence. The remedy would be to send it back to allow resentencing, and that would be the full range of available options, whether it's a dose or whether it's another mitigated sentence. I don't think there would be any basis to foreclose Judge St. Clair from resentencing with a blank slate. Excuse me.
You know, I don't know if you know the answer to this question, but I was having trouble making the numbers add up. I mean, he was serving a 14-month sentence. 2 months into the sentence, he was released on work release and left.
I don't know the answer, but I would assume.
But I mean, what I'm puzzled by is that then the testimony in front of the sentencing judge was that he was going to he was, of course, then re-imprisoned when he was detained, I guess a couple months later.
Yes.
But then he says his release date is December. I just
I'm not certain of that either.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Probably doesn't matter.
Just a couple of brief comments. I'll note that the judge said lots of things in its oral ruling that we didn't directly address because the written findings of fact and conclusions of law that are required by the statute become the framework for analyzing the court's sentence. And the court, in his oral comments, clearly said that he didn't know what sort of legal basis he would have to base this decision on. It's interesting to note. And so we have focused on the written findings, and they're not supported by the law. We've also want to point out that the closest mitigating factor that's listed is the one that he fails to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct, and that one specifically exempts voluntary use of drugs and alcohol as a reason to oppose an exceptional sentence. So the closest possible listed factor cuts against the defendant's argument, even if you assume that the drug use was a basis for the judge's decision. Finally, I just want to note as to the DOSA sentence, there are a lot of defendants who don't want a DOSA sentence, especially when you're only talking about a 22-month range, because it imposes all sorts of restrictions on treatment and on monitoring and that sort of thing. And it's possible that this defendant didn't want to choose that option. I don't know. The record doesn't say.
Unless what happened to this defendant? He, do you know? I mean, in other words, he was serving a 14-month sentence. I mean, he went back to prison, I assume, after appearing in front of Judge St. Clair. Did
I assume
he served 30 days? And
I assume he had to serve out the remainder of the sentence. I did not look closely at the numbers, Your Honor.
Okay.
I can't answer that question.
All right.
So unless the court has any other questions, ask the court to reverse the decision to trial court.
Thank you. All right, that was...